Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And today is February the 2nd, 2025. We are here with Nathan Deshmaker. And I'll tell you, Nathan is full of ideas, and he always comes at things from a perspective that I don't know. Nathan, you still catch me off guard. I was chatting with our engineer during the news break there, and we both were just like, what the heck? Go back to the devil tempting Jesus. Do that one more time, just in case somebody just... Because we were like, wait, what? I'm still discussing with people about the Tower of Babel from, like, back on January 5th when we first talked to you. Like, still ruminating on that. But do that part over again.
Well, that's... So when I say first principles, those are the things I'm talking about. The first principles of good government and law... And you see that organically in our original compacts in the Constitution. So with the Jesus analogy in the Gospels, we are talking about agencies saying, we're going to do this, and citing a statute that gives them the authority to do it. And a lot of times a local official, that's the federal government, there's the law, what do you, we can't do anything about that. So in the Gospels where Jesus was... fasted 40 days, 40 nights in the wilderness, and then Satan came and tempted him. As all three temptations presented to Jesus Christ were presented from an authoritative basis. Turn this stone into bread, cited a statute from Deuteronomy that gave him the authority to do it. And Jesus didn't put his hands up and say, oh, you got me. He went into the rest of the body of the law and cited another passage from Deuteronomy. Man shall not live by bread alone, but every word that proceeded from the mouth of God. And that sequence followed throughout that whole passage and in those three temptations. And those three temptations was the world, was the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. But that's what Jesus did in that is he applied what's called in law the doctrine of imperimateria, which is Latin for all like kind statutes are to be interpreted as a whole. You can't take a Bible verse and rip it out of its context and create a whole doctrine out of that. It is a unit. And it's the same thing with our laws. Our founding fathers happened to be Christian men predominantly and were very well versed in the systemic nature of comparative law and first principles. And no matter how well something sounds, when it breaks with the first principle, it's not good. There's nothing wrong with turning a stone. I mean, Jesus, God in the flesh, what's wrong with turning a stone into bread and satisfying your hunger after not eating for 40 days? What's wrong with that in that context, in that situation, is that it broke from the first principle of the Lord being first, serving the will of his Father. Because Satan was ultimately offering a shortcut to what he already had, or what appeared to be a shortcut. But anyways, with that said, it's just an analogy I often use in the context of how we engage from a local governmental perspective against agencies.
But it's a super good example. I mean, it's a super good example. I guess what that really screams is, this is not a new idea. This issue has been with us for a long time. We've always had somebody who wanted to tell us to do things the wrong way, and a lot of times we're just not good at fighting back.
Yeah, well, and it's so the burden on free people is we have to know the law. Mm-hmm. One of the royal governors in New York in colonial America, there's a letter he wrote to the king at one point, and he said, "I cannot dupe these Americans because they are all lawyers." And what he was, it doesn't mean they were all experts in bureaucratic law. He was referring to the fact that they were so well established in the first principles of law and government and knew their Bibles and were armed.
and
it was very difficult to dupe them through all the mechanisms available through the crown and through the British framework that was ruling in the colonies at the time. And our founding fathers did not push some kind of anarchist anti-law agenda against the crown in England. They actually reached back just like Jesus did, except for they weren't pointing necessarily straight to the scriptures. They went back to Magna Carta, the English Bill of Rights, the English Constitution. That's why some historians have said our founders were more English than the English. They were actually pulling from the organic first principles of common law laid out in over multi-centuries, and reasserted those first principles. And that's why when you read the Declaration of Independence and Constitution, it's pretty overall, especially the Declaration of Independence, it's not this 500-page document. It's concise, straight to the point, understandable. And that's what I was getting to right before the break, is in the ancient world, and it's true today, the power structures always used complex language and legal systems to control individuals and the masses of the people. The Egyptian system of hieroglyphics was highly complex, and only a priest class within that system understood and wielded the power of that language and the law structure. Same thing with the Chinese the Chinese characters, the ancient Chinese languages, very similar. When the Ten Commandments came on the stage through the nation of Israel and Moses, it introduced the law in a 23-letter alphabet a child can understand within Ten Commandments, with all the case law broken down from those 10 first principles. So historically, in the history of the world, that's a revolutionary reality, because what that does is it frees the individual and gives them a reference point to challenge higher powers in the earth. And that's all through history, and that's been part of my study, is studying that phenomenon. Nobodies with no resources triumphing against the powers. I mean, it's David versus Goliath. The problem is today is back to the resource-limited nature we're in at county levels and individuals. Sometimes we get to where we start to study the armor of the Philistines instead of studying David's sling and stone. We try to mimic the enemy instead of relying on God. And so those are principles, and historically you have that language, and our founding fathers and the establishment of our laws in this country, it's a very similar framework. And the organic nature of things, pretty simple. The problem is we've gotten lazy as people,
yeah.
And our founders were adamant about it. I mean, the only thing, James Madison, one of the main architects of the Constitution, said the Constitution's parchment. The only thing that gives it power is a thorough knowledge of the people. So the more we as a people, individuals, break away from the first principles of good governance, the more we invite a system that lords over us and strips us of self-government.
Yeah, I hope this kind of gives, and okay, so for the people who would maybe go to these meetings, support people who would actually do the heavy lifting, what advice would you give them besides kind of doing their homework?
Well, I will say, in these meetings, like when you're meeting with agencies, obviously I don't, I appreciate this program and things like this I can go on where I can share some of the broader, you know, because what I'm talking about from the spiritual side, that's the real motivating factor for me. But when I'm in a procedural type stuff, trying to deal with agency, writing documents or sitting in a meeting, I ordinarily don't make a bunch of theological arguments. But those principles are applied in what I do. So first, be rooted in first principles. Know where you come from as a people. When it comes to engaging on, and maybe we can shift now a little bit in the conversation, winding down this second hour, of getting into a couple case examples of where we...
Yeah.
In the last year, working with counties and a couple coalitions, shut down some major regulatory processes that the Biden administration was pushing forward.
Which one do you want to do? I have one on my screen to see if you're reading my mind.
I sent you three items.
You did?
I'm game with starting with either one. There's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biological diversity rules. There's the U.S. Forest Service old growth amendments that were promulgated. And then there's the National Interest Electric Transmission Corridors that were being pushed through the Bible Belt in Kansas.
I was kind of excited about that one because the energy thing is coming for all of us, and especially what we are learning and have learned recently from you and others about, you know, AI and the draw and all that. So your title on it was Department of Energy Retreats from Several States After Local Opposition. It's like, that's exciting. That's, you know, what can you, what would you like to tell people about that?
Yeah, so for the folks that did listen to the first program, it was the National Interest Electric Transmission Corridor issue. It wasn't that, but that was the second thing that brought the artificial intelligence stuff to my attention. So for those of you who don't know what the National Interest Electric Transmission Corridors are, those are Department of Energy. The Congress back in 2001 authorized Department of Energy under the Federal Power Act to establish national interest electric transmission corridors through the Department of Energy, which is a federal agency, and also provided permitting authorities to FERC. And so after that power was established, Department of Energy went about in the early thousands to establish these national interest electric transmission corridors. And they're not transmission lines. They're corridors that set the boundaries and buffer regions where they can site transmission lines and use the power of eminent domain to build them out. So they tried that back in the early thousands. One of them was a large one through California. They were litigated, and the Ninth Circuit, surprisingly enough, sometimes you get some decisions out of the Ninth Circuit that are halfway decent, and they shut that whole project down. And then it never came back. The National Interest Electric Transmission Corridor never was brought back anywhere. But the other thing the 2001 amendments did is it directed Department of Energy to do every three years they'd publish a needs study where they look back on the grid and assess the congestions and constraints that are being experienced on the grid so that they can plan to increase transmission capacity or whatnot, so people, actually consumers, end-use electric consumers, actually are getting their electricity reliably and affordably. So those needs studies were retroactive, where they looked back in the past and assessed those congestions and constraints. In 2021, the Nancy Pelosi-controlled Congress and the Biden administration and the Jobs and Investments Act amended the Federal Power Act again and gave Department of Energy even broader authority and directed them to project their 3 years needs study into the future. So now, since 2021 and then 2023, Department of Energy published their 3 years needs study, and guess what they found in their publication projecting that forward? We're going to experience massive congestion and constraints on our grid. And why is that? Because the federal government went about to build out all this wind and solar that's not tied into the grid. So if they were to look retroactively like they did till 2021 and project and look at the past, so what actually happened, 2023, Department of Energy published that report, and they said there's massive congestion and constraint coming to the grid in the future. And what is that being driven by? Renewable energy and AI data centers. And then they put out phase two of their preliminary National Interest Electric Transmission Corridor study. And they plotted out massive corridors across Kansas into New Mexico, Nebraska, the Dakotas, one through parts of California and a couple out on the East Coast, as a preliminary map for where these corridors would site or would sit. And like I said earlier, the corridors would allow Department of Energy to site transmission lines. It would allow the federal government to bypass state and local permitting authorities, because traditionally, all through the history of this nation, states and local governments have always wielded eminent domain and transmission siting for those systems and utilities. So we have this huge shift in the federal government with this renewable energy push and Department of Energy with these corridors. So that's the backdrop of how that came about. And Kansas Natural Resource Coalition is a coalition of counties in Kansas, and other counties and commissioners were getting lots of phone calls when this came out, this phase two map, and people were not very happy with what this looked like. So the really neat thing about this is several counties held public meetings and did educational meetings and public meetings and formed their constituency. A white paper was drafted, and I assisted in that, and that was disseminated around the state of Kansas. It was also disseminated to D.C. It was disseminated into some of the surrounding states as well, and we held a briefing call with quite a few commissioners from several other states. Oklahoma, Missouri, New Mexico, and other states came onto that call. We had an hour and a half briefing call where we educated on the issue, what it is, what Department of Energy is pushing, and the problems with it. And not too long after that, the Oklahoma Attorney General started getting involved. I don't know if we contributed to that or not, but long story short is this is an interesting process, because and usually we're submitting substantive documents to these federal agencies in rulemaking. In this case, it was at a preliminary phase. There was no regulatory process in place. And just by local grassroots resistance and education and circulating a white paper and a certain county commissioner and a county attorney getting Department of Energy on the phone and making it very, very clear, because these corridors also would open up billions of dollars of finance through the Inflation Reduction Act. So the county commissioner flat out
told. Let's find out. Hang on to that thought just one second. Let's take a really quick break and come back. I don't want to break that up, but get into how that Inflation Reduction Act was going to feed that and what that was going to do. Because that's obviously not the only place it's happening or going to happen, and that's this kind of stuff I think people need to watch for on the ground and be smart about. So we will be back with our guest, Nathan Deshmaker. And I picked this song because it always reminds me of Nathan. It's kind of long, but you're going to like it. You can hear us at
WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Anytime online.
There you go.
Oh, what I would do to have the kind of strength it takes to stand before a giant. With just a sling and a stone, surrounded by the sound of a thousand warriors, shaking in their armor, wishing they'd have had the strength to stand. But the giant's calling out my name, and he laughs at me, reminding me of all the times I tried before and failed. The giant keeps on telling me, time and time again, boy, you'll never win. You'll never win. But the voice of truth tells me a different story. The voice of truth says, do not be afraid. And the voice of truth says, this is for my glory. Out of all the voices calling, the stone pushes the rocks.
We have to rewrite that song. We need Weird Al to do a new one for us, because when the lights go down in the city, I don't want to be anywhere near it.
No, no, thank you.
All right. Back to Nathan.
Yeah, just really, I guess I'll just summarize the corridor issue there. What it boiled down to was everything I explained, and then a county and a county attorney getting Department of Energy on the phone and stating pretty plainly that if this is about finance, you better find another way, because we will use coordination and every legal avenue available to us if you put these corridors through our counties to oppose it. So that process happened through last summer in 2024 into the fall, and about a week and a half before Christmas, Department of Energy reached out to the executive director of that coalition of counties and said, "We're going to put the notice out next week. We're withdrawing those corridors out of Kansas."
Oh, that's too bad. Can you, hey Nathan, can you move your microphone just a teensy bit? It's having kind of the foofing sound a little bit.
How about now?
Yeah, that's good. And so talk about the infrastructure, because the Infrastructure Act, I should say, the cannon of money that, you know, has been shot all over the country. What kind of money were they looking at, and how, and had they already applied for it? Was it grants they were going to have to do? What was the mechanism?
Yeah, so I should have that pulled up, but the Jobs and Investments Act opened up several billion dollars.
Okay. I mean,
I don't remember the exact number, but it was billions of dollars of finance loans, Department of Energy loans. And the way it was written, too, they're forgivable loans as well. If these entities got into those programs and didn't finish the projects, there was loan forgiveness provisions in statute.
So there is free
lunch. In that body of law. Yep. So Milton Friedman remarked years ago, inflation is a result of inaccurate assessment of the true cost of government policies as much as it is a result of government spending itself. And when the Biden administration and these agencies pushed the wind and solar development and building out, because they also massivized wind and solar buildouts, when they did the assessments, the economic impacts analyses for those, if they even did them, they did not take into consideration and assess the resulting buildout of massive transmission systems to tie those into the grid.
Of course not, because we don't ever think it all the way through before we pull the trigger. And interestingly enough, how much of that has gone out around other, do you have any idea, like what a volume of that has gone out around the country that now is going to be this disjointed, just, you know, like our train to nowhere? I think most people have kind of followed that, the slow speed rail that they've, you know, dropped gazillions of dollars into. I couldn't even tell you how much.
Yeah. I don't have a specific number, but the genius, if you want to call it that, behind the Inflation Reduction Act and this Jobs and Investments Act and other laws, but those two primarily, is the Democratic Party was able to entrench billions of dollars of renewable energy projects into the hearts and corners of even Republican districts. And that is one of the fights that is now propped up. Because when the Inflation Reduction Act passed, I'm pretty sure there was not a single Republican that voted for it. Every single one opposed it. But the problem with Republicans and conservatives on the ground is sometimes people just go where the money flows. And even Republican districts and others bought into, you know, the grants for building EV charging stations, windmills, solar panels, and all this renewable infrastructure. So now you've entrenched billions of dollars into projects that are either built out or in process of being built out, or in the preliminary permitting stages of coming online to allow for the build out. So now the Trump administration has to come into that mess And the Congress even has to try to deal with that mess. And in my opinion, the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, in its entirety should go away. But there's going to be massive efforts to keep parts of that intact for the particular reason that there's a lot of investments across the country that haven't been realized. But the thing is, though, most of these investments wouldn't have happened in a free market.
See,
it was 100% subsidized.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. It's a little bit, you know, we always go back to Solyndra, right? I think that was our that was our big wake-up call. Like, wait, what? We gave a whole bunch of money to this company that, it's all kind of Solyndra and then more Solyndra. However, once these communities do sort of get in the grant process, nobody wants to let that go. I know that happened when they said they were putting a pause out. I mean, that made the, you know, phone lines light up in the congressional offices, just to, I think, put it mildly. What about our project? Oh, my God, what about me? It's like, oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Well, right there, though, that's a signal of the fact that we as a people have become dependent.
Yeah.
That's what I tell legislators sometimes when they vote on these handout programs is you need to stop celebrating the 4th of July every time you do that.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I'm kind of chuckling because I have a perfect song for that. I either have a meme for it or a song for it. That's like my answer to everything. I got a meme. I got a song. No, but I don't know how you know, when you get back to the self-reliance, and maybe we should read that in school again. That was an essay that was really important when I was teaching in the 80s. I made every single one of my students read that essay. You know, self-reliance is something that should be a pillar of our republic. I don't know when that stopped, but...
Well, another term is self-determination.
It was the government cheese.
So, self-government, self-determination, self-reliance. Self-determination means, in a civic context, it means the ability for a local political entity to exercise internal governance without external compulsion. And like Montana Constitution, for example, guarantees to the people of Montana a system of self-government. Lots of local county policy guarantee and provide for self-government. But when you become dependent on outside sources and outside influences, you lose self-governance. You know, like our governor, for example, he brags about Montana having a balanced budget and even a surplus, which is great, but at the same time he says that, he's cost-sharing at the tune of millions of dollars deficit spending from the federal treasury that at the end of the day subordinates the state to the federal government. And, you know, there's a lot of benefits with money and cash flows coming into a state maybe, but what's lost, though, is the guarantee of internal self-governance, which is embedded within the original compacts that created the state in the first place. So is that a good trade is the question. Look at public education, for example. I just used this with a friend of mine the other day when we were having this discussion. Public education is another prime example. I'm out in the middle of nowhere where I went to school, Grass Range, and, you know, and I was fortunate because we had, like, local women that cooked for us. We had, like, home-cooked meals most of the time.
That's cool.
But the irony is, nice, because we took federal money, the school, you know, there was, you know, one day a week there was food that wasn't, well, it was cooked by those same ladies, but it was the prepackaged food that the school basically had to, if they wanted to get the federal monies, they had to incorporate a certain amount of that food into the menu. So once a week we had to eat soy burgers, for example.
Yeah.
And so right there's a perfect example. You know, local governments and local people are like, well, if we don't take the money, somebody else will. Well, what do we buy with the money? Is it really worth taking the money if we're going to buy a soy burger to feed our kids in school? when we live in cattle country, I'll donate a cow. But what kind of a trade is that even? It's like, well, the money, it's like when they're, when you're told how to use the money in advance and, and you won't get the money unless you feed a soy burger once a week, that's not a good deal.
No, that is not a good deal. And yet that's a really good analogy for where a lot of this goes. You wind up with programs.
Yeah, you invent the program to get the money.
Kind of.
When you really didn't need the program.
But then what do you do with the people that are working in the program when the funding for the program goes away? Because then those people still need jobs, so you wind up morphing that program into some big long continuation of such that maybe you would never have done because...
Yeah. Well, you always end up paying for it.
Well, if you use if you used your market-driven analogy, is that something that would have come through the free market? Likely not.
Likely not.
Likely not.
Well, why would people in the heart of Montana, where the predominant industry is livestock production, feed their kids a soy burger at school?
Yeah, right.
We don't even have, we can't even make a soy burger here.
Was that the day that everybody used to bring their lunch? Like from home?
Yeah, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like, that's a bologna sandwich day because they're going to try to feed us garbage at school again. Yeah. Wow.
Well, that was the day I brought a sack lunch.
Yeah, right. That's what I was thinking. Like every kid in school goes, ooh, you know, it's soy burger day. And then, you know, you get into that whole thing of you're not meeting the need of the population. So much of that soy burger stuff, you know, went into your local soy burger landfill. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just crazy. Well, the Infrastructure and Jobs Act was so much money, and it was so huge and so pervasive that pulling that back starts to become a little bit of a challenge. And I think that's what they found was, okay, we're going to stop everything. Okay, well, stopping everything. Everything's big. We could stop part of it. I don't know how that's going to come out, but I do believe we'll do.
Well, it should be a big wake-up call for communities that, hey, we really got dependent on the federal government here. Let's
I've sat through many public meetings where people have said, hey, this grant money isn't good. I mean, this is obligating us to stuff we don't necessarily want to continue. And once we get in here, how do we get out?
Right.
Because then you need the next thing, because now you have you've created a whole new it's more bureaucracy in a lot of cases, not all.
Well, a lot of times that money's all precedented on the first so many years will help you pay for it. After that, it's on you. Well, that just means when that money runs out, those programs
are
going to go away.
Let's play a little government cheese and come back with our friend Nathan for the end of the hour. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Give a man a free house and he'll bust out the windows, put his family on food stamps. Now he's a big spender, no food on the table, and the bills ain't paid, cause he's spending on cigarettes and PGA. They'll turn us all into beggars, cause they're easier to please. They're feeding our people that government cheese. All the gold in California is in a bank in the middle of Beverly Hills in somebody else's name. So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter. A brand new game.
Isn't that the truth? Oh, so there we go. We got the cap on California and make fun of government cheese. So there you go.
Yeah, we're hitting them all.
It's been worth coming in. It's been worth getting out of my sick bay and coming and hanging out with Nathan and Bill and David. Let's include everybody. So, Nathan, I still can't get past the soy burgers. It's still funny to me. silly and ridiculous. So, let's see. Fish and Wildlife surrenders effort to finalize biological integrity, diversity, and environmental health regulations. So for people who don't live in the, you know, in the West or in rural areas, why do they care about that?
So with a lot of people it may not affect, but there's a national wildlife refuge system, and there's, you know, there's not BLM lands in every state or Forest Service lands in every state, but there are refuges administered by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in, I'm pretty sure, every state. Some are bigger than others. We have one in the middle of Montana, 1.1 million acre Charles M. Russell Game Reserve. And that is the cornerstone that a multinational nonprofit is buying out ranches around to tie into that to create a 3.5 million acre conservation reserve. So when the Biden administration started to promulgate regulations to change the way for the refuge system is being managed, we obviously took note of that pretty quickly and engaged on those items, because it affects a lot of counties that surround that refuge, and there's refuges in other states as well. What these policy changes essentially did, well, they did a lot of things, but the key elements is it, they prioritized acquisition boundaries where they create buffers around the refuges that authorize U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to buy out the private lands within those buffer regions. And as soon as they acquire those lands, they become a part of the refuge. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a wildlife dominant mission, and all human activity and use is secondary on the refuge system. And so, like, the CMR in Montana, for example, has enjoyed long-established cattle use, animal unit months, on that refuge from the beginning under the Taylor Grazing Act. They have been retiring cattle use and AUMs off the CMR for a long time. These policies would have, regulatory changes would have exacerbated that. In these changes, they defined historical conditions as composition, structure, and function of ecosystems that existed prior to ecological degradation caused by anthropogenic changes. So the whole regulatory priority was pre-human conditions. And the regulations also, under Section 6, Agricultural Uses, states we prohibit the use of agricultural practices unless they are determined necessary to meet statutory requirements, fulfill refuge purposes, and ensure biological integrity, diversity, and environmental health. So these regulatory changes was a part of the Biden administration's climate change agenda to permanently conserve 30% of lands and waters by 2050 and to shut off access and utilization by egg production in and around the game refuges or the wildlife refuges across the nation. So in Montana, we engaged on those issues because we have a large buffer region they're trying to create around a refuge in southwestern Montana, and that's a 5.7 million acre
holy cow
footprint around a 55,000 acre refuge that they want us to create a buffer that would authorize them to acquire land, the lands within that 5.7 million acre footprint, which, by the way, that acreage is larger than a lot of states.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a big issue on that front.
I was going to say, when they do that, when they lock up that much land, A, it's no longer public land, so there's a major issue there.
Yeah.
But, you know, what if, I don't know the configuration of that ground, but is that just increased fire hazard, no management, all that, or is that not a factor where you are?
Well, in that case, it was the Missouri Headwaters Conservation Area, which, yeah, there's a ton of, it's a ton of mountainous, I mean, you have the Rocky Mountains through that region, there's large mountain ranges that run through that footprint, there's large valleys, you have, that's the headwaters of the Missouri River, so that's, you have the Gallatin, the Madison, the Jefferson, the Ruby River, and a whole large watershed flows out of that part of the state and ultimately into the Missouri River. So yeah, it would lead to potential impacts on for mining and everything else. And the worst part about it is it authorizes the purchase of perpetual conservation easements and outright buying the private lands within those boundaries. And like I said, when they buy the land, they either create another refuge out of it or it absorbs into the existing refuge. But the good news is we engaged every step of the way on those items over the last 2-3 years, and it was actually really neat. E&E News, which is a pretty high dollar subscription that a lot of policy think tanks and governors and representatives across the nation subscribe to, and the environmental lobby, back in March or maybe it was May, E&E specifically cited one of our county commissioners and the comments that were developed in that article in opposition to this. And this was another thing that before Christmas last year that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service put a notice of withdrawal of the regulatory changes on the Federal Register, and which is really surprising because usually at the tail end of an administration like the Biden administration, they just ram through everything they can.
Right.
And they did that here. They were doing that here, so they took their eye off the ball with you.
Well, they did it all. It's not that they didn't do that. They did that on some other things. They tried it on the sage grouse stuff too, and they got some of those things in place. But for whatever reason, in combination of the work we had done and some others, there was also national pressure as well. There was enough substantive comment and product on their desk that they withdrew that rule. And the other item was the sage grouse that didn't get finalized in Montana. And then the one other thing, the U.S. Fish and, or U.S. Forest Service old growth amendments, Biden administration also set out to amend like 128 forest plans across, I think, 10 states to prioritize old growth forests. And another area that we heavily engaged on, there was coalitions of counties out of New Mexico, Arizona, Montana, and other associations that supported a substantive work document by Boundary Line Foundation, which is an organization that I do work with sometimes and help with research and writing. So we developed a work product for a variety of constituents across multi-states on the old growth forest rule, and that is another one that surprisingly was withdrawn prior to 2025. So those are three items that were, you know, we had a lot of wins under the first go-around with the Trump administration in the first 4 years where we found the Trump administration was very responsive to local governmental input. The Biden administration, we just did what we could to equip the record. We were preparing for litigation if the Biden administration were to continue forward. And I'm sure the fact that Trump was the incumbent president probably contributed a little bit to the withdrawal of these because they knew that was going to be a pressure there too. But it also, I think it speaks to the importance of the work we're doing though, of getting local governments and associations engaged in the rulemaking process with these agencies and calling them out at the forefront.
Yeah.
And then they don't have a streamline to just push it through, and we throw a big wrench in the process and slow it. If we don't stop it altogether, we most definitely feed some bureaucracy into the process, slow it down, and force them to look at things that otherwise they wouldn't consider.
Well, you guys had 54,000 comments, public comment. I mean, that's no small effort.
Well, that wasn't all from us. I mean, there was a lot of other...
No, but on that topic, I mean,
that issue,
that's amazing.
Yeah, a whole bunch. So, same with the biological integrity rule. There was a large... And that's what's neat is when I first started doing this work 7-8 years ago, you know, there was some of that going on the conservative front. You know, the environmental lobby is always hammering stuff in these processes. But it's been encouraging to see, you know, that I'm not the only one. Well, the other encouraging thing is when you help counties and help others engage and then they learn in the process, and then something comes along and they do something about it, like that county commissioner in Kansas, for example, and other examples where they're able to handle themselves. You know, they don't always have to call me or whoever the, whoever they're working with. They start to, and that's my vision. That's my hope in this whole process of doing and putting all the sweat equity in that I have is to hopefully train others up and help others that are a good study to and in elected positions to be able to handle themselves so that when an agency comes in, even though they may not know all the ins and outs of what they're proposing,
right,
a county commissioner that knows his authorities, understands the agency's not being totally transparent necessarily, it's very powerful when commissioners are well positioned and can challenge them right off the gate.
Well, and it's really helpful when the citizens are productive, because it's one thing for everybody to be mad and all that, but that doesn't really move the needle. And people can't, conservatives kind of stink at being mad long term, which is what I kind of like about them. They tend to be mad in spikes, and then they go have a barbecue and everybody kind of gets along again, and that's sometimes where, you know, the left is still grinding its axe in the background slowly, and we're out living our lives, doing our jobs, and we're like, what the hell, they're still mad? Oh my God, they're still working on that? And it kind of catches us still off guard periodically, but there are some things that people have learned to watch for, and one is that when it comes to public meetings that the agencies do at state and federal, both, they'll do these Delphi meetings where you go into the public meeting and either they have you all set up at little tables with post-it notes and you're going to have small group discussion, or you have to walk around a room and meet at little stations so that you can have a person explain to you one little piece of the project. And by separating everybody, there's no group force. And what we have learned, what I've watched over and over is, first thing, there was one that was the best. People went in the room, they saw all the chairs set up in these little tables. They immediately put all the tables, they folded them all up, put them against the wall, took all the chairs, stacked them up, and stood there. And just stood there as a big mass of like 75 people staring these people down. And it was like, game changer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like, our meeting just changed. And it makes it a little less, I don't know, friendly, or it just ungreases the skids, maybe. Skids are still on,
well,
maybe.
The Delphi technique's all about creating consensus.
Right.
And sometimes you can do that and there's some consensus, but when there's a lot of things there's not consensus on. And another thing, just to really just to note on that, sometimes in some cases with counties, we exercise our coordination powers where the county holds the meeting and brings the agency to the table.
There you go.
So that changes the dynamics too, is you actually hold the meeting, you take the minutes, you run the agenda, and you put the agency in the chair on the other side. So that's oftentimes very effective as well.
Yeah, sometimes you have to just be a little bit clever and kind of patient, but once people get the hang of it, and they have to show up. I mean, what kind of a value do you put on the showing up for the public? Like, what's your elevator speech for showing up?
Yeah, it's crucial. The constitutional republic that was drafted by our founding fathers requires citizen involvement, and individual people that know their heritage show up and say something.
Yeah.
You can't be silent.
Yeah, so the old, it doesn't matter, I'm just one person, yada, yada, yada. That just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It doesn't solve our problems, and the people that have been elected need your help. You can't just blame them for everything and walk away and expect miracles to occur. Nathan, we have run out of time, believe it or not. We super appreciate you coming on board with us again today, and we hope you have a spectacular time at your new house with all your projects, and we will look forward to seeing you again very soon.
Yep. Thanks for coming on, Nathan.
There we go. Never any rest
Thank
for the wicked.
Grow our trees. We got bills to pay. We got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down. We can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.